This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Michael Evans. How are you, Michael?
Doing great, thanks.
Excellent, excellent. That's a Californian accent, wasn't it?
Probably a little bit of California with a little bit of Washington, D.C. mixed in, but definitely gringo.
Okay. The reason it's gringo is because we're going to be talking about Argentina, or in particular, one of the things that's been popular in wine for a while is people getting hold of their own vineyards. So we're going to do a couple of interviews. This first one, we're going to talk about your main business, if you like, and then sort of a little bit about what that means for the region, etc.
Fantastic.
So do you want to just tell us what exactly you do there, Michael?
The Vines of Mendoza started as a happy accident. I was on vacation in Argentina. I was supposed to be there for 3 weeks back in 2004. And while I was there, I went to Mendoza and met my founding partner, Pablo Jimenez. And we hit it off from the beginning. But I was really struck by Argentina back then because it's not only incredibly beautiful, the wines are elegant, stunning, rich, deep. But it seemed then, and in many respects still today, seems undeveloped. It seemed like Napa Valley, not 10 or 20 years ago, but Napa Valley maybe 50 years ago, with just a huge opportunity to create wines and have wonderful experiences. And so what started as a vacation turned into the Vines of Mendoza.
Okay, and what is the Vines of Mendoza? Do you make wine or...?
Well, so during this weekend that I spent in Mendoza, as I fell in love with the place, I started talking to Pablo, whose family's been making wine in Mendoza for generations. And
yep.
We got to talking, and I said, well, you know, why don't I buy a couple acres here, and then your family can farm it, and I'll come back each year to make some wine. And as I started talking about this idea with my friends back home in the States, they said, well, look, if you're going to buy a little land, I want to as well. So all of a sudden, instead of my little idea of a few acres, I had 10 friends that each wanted to buy 10 acres, so we had 100 acres. We had a decent size project. Yep. And then the light bulb went off, that there are a lot of people like me that have this dream or this fantasy of owning a vineyard and making their own wines. And so then it started from, it evolved from an interesting idea for me into actually a business where we could offer small private vineyards, turnkey, managed for people that love wine and they want to take it to the next level.
Okay, so... that's the magic word, isn't it? Turnkey, which means what, really?
Well, all of our owners, and today we have 212 owners from all over the world, they have their day jobs. They are finance people and doctors and lawyers all over the world. And wine is their outlet, their passion, the thing they do for fun. So the last thing they want to do is try and figure out how to register their label with the governing authority in their country or in Argentina, or figure out how to pay the Social Security taxes of somebody that's working on their vineyard. So we take an age-old concept, which is taking basically a community of people together so that you can share resources and share expenses to keep costs down to be able to farm a vineyard and make great wines. They've been doing this in Burgundy and different parts of the world all of the year. They don't, all over the for hundreds of years. You know, they everyone doesn't buy a tractor or even a horse. They share with their neighbor, and it makes a lot more sense. So in that way, we've now have these 212 owners who make their wine, and each of them have their own small vineyard. The average size is just about 3 acres, so a little larger than a hectare. And each of them have their own vineyards that they plant. We plant to their specifications. We've got 33 different varietals. Most of them is Malbec, and then Cabernet Franc is number two. We've got a wide variety of varietals and a lot of experimentation going on.
Sure. Let's just understand the situation. So you have people, or you approach people, you get customer leads and who are interested in having a vineyard.
Basically, it's completely organic. So we started with these 10 friends, and then as we started with them, they talked about it with their friends, and if we could do a family tree of our customers, our owners, they've all come from friends of other owners, and it's just developed that way over the last 12-13 years.
And how long has it been running for?
It'll be 14 years in November.
Okay, so it's still quite new.
It's quite new. We found our vineyard and bought the vineyard in 2006. We looked at 76 different properties all over Mendoza.
Yeah.
Spent about a year looking around. Finally found the right piece of property. Planted our first vines in 2007.
Yep.
And then we opened the winery in 2010. And then finally, 4 years ago, we opened the Vines Resort and Spa. So our owners had a great place to stay when they come and visit to do their blending or harvesting.
Okay. So it does sound like quite a nice idea if someone's got some money and they want to own a vineyard. But do they actually make any money out of the wines? You know, where is the focus on the wine? Is it because 6 acres, 10 acres or more makes a heck of a lot of wine that your normal person wouldn't normally drink in a week or in a year?
Certainly does. You can make a lot of wine. I mean, for an average vineyard of 3 acres, you could make 6,000 premium wine, something that might retail in here for £20, or 4,000 bottles of a super premium, something that might be £40 or £50. So there is a lot of wine. So most of our owners make one or two barrels, 300 or 600 bottles, 25 or 50 cases, and then we sell off the rest of the grapes for them on their behalf to other wineries in the region. And because of the brand that's developed around Vines of Mendoza grapes, we're able to get good prices for those. So they'll get some revenue from the vineyard and then use that to pay for their farming costs and some of their winemaking.
Okay. And what does the total cost come out at a bottle of wine? You know, if I'm a, let's say, I just want to get some numbers.
Sure.
I'm just trying to understand the situation. 5 acre site, how many much wine do you think you'll come off that?
Well, you could make between 10 and 20,000 bottles. Most people would just make a barrel or two, so 300 or 600 bottles. So a typical owner would sell off most of their grapes and then make a barrel or two. And then the costs depend on the quality of wine that people want to make. So if you want to make a premium wine, something that might retail for $20 in the U.S., your cost would be about between $4.50 and $5.50 per bottle. Mm-hmm. A super premium wine might go as high as $14 or $15, largely because of the cost of oak to be able to have those extra costs in there. And they have a nicer bottle, a nicer label, and all of that stuff. Between $5 and $14 for the reds. Rosé, whites might get lower because they don't need oak and they need less time. So those costs might go down to $3.50 or $4.
Okay, so you're getting your wines at a discount, but how much money have you invested up front to get that?
The average vineyard, they started about $100,000.
Yeah.
And they go up depending on the size. Our largest vineyard owner has 21 acres, so they invested quite a lot. But a typical investment is between $200,000 and $250,000.
Okay, that's still quite a chunky amount of money, isn't it?
It's a lot of money, for sure. It's a big investment to have a vineyard. I think part of the opportunity is it's just a really unique experience. And they're able to do it while $100,000 is a lot of money. To go buy your own vineyard as a standalone, you're talking millions of dollars. So while it's expensive, it's certainly much more accessible than buying an entire project yourself.
Yeah, I understand that. So as a business, it would I've seen on your website that there is a couple, you know, one of the examples you gave was a couple who own a restaurant and they run the wines through the restaurant. Do you get many people like that, or is it very much just a couple people who want a couple of cases?
10 to 15% of our owners sell some of their wine.
Yeah.
In terms of a real business, couple percent of people do it. They do it and they sell it because, as you know, it's lots of people make pretty good wine. A few people make great wine. It's really challenging to sell the wine. And frankly, for most of our owners, when it goes beyond that, from the fun and learning and creating their own wine to turning it into a business, then it loses a lot of the fun and the passion around it. So we do help a number of our owners to sell. A lot of our owners might sell a few cases here and there, or when they go out to their favorite restaurant, their wine on the wine list of a few of their favorite restaurants. But most of our owners, as a business, they much prefer to spend their business time working on their real job and their fun time in their vineyard.
Okay. I suppose one of the fun things, well, there's lots of fun things that you can do if you're going to be making wines.
Sure.
You know, you get to choose the grape varieties. You sort of said Cabernet Franc was quite popular, which is not a grape variety I normally associate with Argentina. I think Mendoza, I think Malbec, Bondara, and
Torontes maybe on the white side.
Yeah, exactly. Chardonnay, that sort of thing.
Well, Cabernet Franc, I think, is probably the next big thing from Argentina, or the current big thing. It's doing very well. Because of the high desert, especially in the Uco Valley, it is it's got that intensity of great Cab Franc and that intensity of a nice high desert Malbec, but it because of the heat, it doesn't have that green kind of green pepper, that greenness feeling you get a lot from the traditional French Cabernet Francs. And a lot of people really enjoy that intensity without so much of the Parisinas that are giving you that green pepper flavor. So it's really special. It also does very well as a blending grape, either as anywhere from 5 to 50% of a match with Malbec.
Okay. So the people who are choosing the vineyards, do you give them advice on saying, you know, if you want to make X amount of money, Malbec's the way to go, or, you know, you wouldn't necessarily be recommending Sangiovese perhaps to
people? For sure. I mean, clearly from a commercial perspective, when selling either your, especially your grapes, Malbec is the highest, has the highest prices in the market. Cabernet Franc is almost as high. But if you are going to branch out and you love Chardonnay, that is not going to create the highest value for your grape planting. So some people, they know going in, depending on what they're planting, is going to affect the economics of their vineyard, of course.
Okay. And do you give them numbers to help them make that decision?
Of course. I mean, our job is to guide them along the path. So for many owners, they might start off and they know that all of our owners are passionate wine enthusiasts, and they care a lot about wine, and they engage a lot of it. They travel around the world. They drink a lot of it, of course. But they don't necessarily know how to make it. They don't know how the decisions are made. So they might come in the first year and say, you know what? I love big, intense wines. Let's make a wine that's kind of like a big Napa Cab. Just give me a big fruit bomb with lots of alcohol. And so, you know, the first year we'll make that. And then we educate them over time and say, okay, well, when you do that, there's certain things that we're going to do. This is how we're going to prune. We're going to do a big green harvest. We're going to leave the vines, the grapes on the vines a little while longer, et cetera, to make those things, to make that big wine. And lo and behold, 2, 3, 4 years later, they're coming in and making those decisions. They're saying, you know what? Let's harvest a little later. Instead of, I want to get it up by 24 and a half, 25 bricks this year. And let's do an extended maceration for 5 days instead of 2 days, because so I can get a little more extraction out of it. And you know what? I want to go with a medium toast instead of the on the barrel instead of the heavy toast that we used last year. So they start making more and more of the decisions, and they become the winemaker. So that wine, that bottle of wine at the end of the day, there's a pride of ownership, pride of creation around that. We are not simply making wines for them. The idea is that they really become the winemaker and make those key decisions.
Okay, so it's the key decisions they get to make. I presume they can get as involved as they want, really.
They can get as much or as little as involved. I mean, some of our owners are very busy, and we talk to them and do a conference call twice a year to check in on the vineyards and do a plan. And others, we're on the phone with them every week, and we're saying, okay, we're in the vineyards, and saying, you know what? We're slightly short on the target bricks for you, but it looks like there's a storm coming next week. Do we pick? You want to take the risk that it's going to come out a little green, or do you want to roll the dice and we wait and see if it dries up after? So we engage the ones that want to be on a very detailed level. And then, of course, many of them come down for harvest to pick some of their grapes and do some of the sorting. And virtually all of our owners come down each year to do the blending. That's, of course, when they have the greatest impact on the quality and style of their wine, when they can come down and, all right, take this barrel of Malbec and say, all right, let's finish it. What does it need? It was a really hot year this year, so maybe it needs a little more in the mid-palate. So let's try it with a little Merlot. Or we want to pump it up a little bit, let's put a little Cab Franc in there, or whatever they to meet their desires of that final wine.
Okay, and then each wine's got its own label, isn't it? So they produce their own label, and then you deal with, as you're saying earlier, all the logistics, the legal stuff.
Yeah, that, I think that's one of the most fun parts of the process. So as soon as someone buys a vineyard with us, we set them up with a marketing team and start a discussion. And say, okay, have you thought about your label? Have you thought about your name? Are you thinking about, and there's a lot of decisions that go into that. Are you thinking about you might want to sell it? Do you want to be able to register it and protect it as a trademark? And of course, you know, millions and millions of names have been registered for wine, so you've got to be careful about that. You've got to do background checks. Do you want to have a label that's fun? Do you want to have a label that's traditional? Do you want to have a label that's modern? And we start working through the name and the label with our marketing team and each owner. And so over time, it usually takes 6 to 9 months, we develop that label with them, send them samples, tweak it, colors, and then eventually, once we have the label finalized, we'll also, of course, work in the bottle, the type of bottle, the capsule, the cork, packaging, all of those other things that go along with it as well.
Okay, let's have a wee chat about the wines of Mendoza then.
The
vines of Mendoza. So you guys have been here for 12 years. You've got how big is your winemaking team?
We've got 3 winemakers, and then our consulting winemaker is Santiago Chaval, who founded a Chaval Ferrer, one of the greatest winemakers in Argentina. So those are our senior team. In addition to that, we have a wine director, this wonderful woman, Mariana, who is a kind of a translator for our owners, not in a Spanish to English sense, although she does that as well. This is really to say, okay, Chris, this is the type of wine that you want to create. because you want to have this elegant wine, these are the decisions that we should make in the vineyard. These are the decisions we should make in the winery, so that she goes through that education process to help them make those decisions.
Oh my God, that must be a tough job.
It is a tough job, but you know.
Oh my Lordy.
And imagine it with 212 different people, and many of those 212 different people have husbands or wives that may disagree with their taste.
So
she's got a tough job for sure.
That's going to be harder than the winemaker, because at least the winemaker is just implementing what she's discussed.
Right.
So, yeah, it keeps the pressure off the winemaker a little bit. Yeah, okay. And does that mean, in terms of your setup, they don't necessarily have their own winemaking facilities on site?
We make all of the wine in our winery. It's a very specifically custom-built facility.
Yeah.
We make very small batches of wine.
Yeah, I was going to say.
We have 107 one-ton steel fermenters. So most of our wine are made in that. It's interesting. So across the street there, we close to Le Siete or Salentine, some of the bigger wineries, and they'll make millions and millions of bottles of wine. But they will make maximum 10 or 15 different wines. We, on the other hand, make 350 different wines, but a total of a couple hundred thousand. So we have 10 to 20 times more different wines, which makes it more complex, but it also gives us more data. So every year we're able to sit down with those 350 wines and say, okay, which are the ones that came out a little better? Which are the ones that struggled a little bit and why? And start seeing trends of, okay, this one maybe got fertilized a little earlier, or this one we did the green harvest a little stronger, or this one was harvested before the rains, or this one was harvested after the rains. And so over time, crunching this data gives us the ability to make better wines faster than I think anyone in Argentina and maybe over time and anywhere in the world. I mean, I don't think anyone other than the mega wine companies would come anywhere near to making 300 different wines, and certainly not in one winery.
Okay, and have you got, what sort of IT infrastructure have you got for analyzing that?
You know, it's still, we're developing that. It's still relatively rudimentary with Excel and Google Docs, and you know, part of it is winemaking is that blend of art and science, right? So we provide the data, but also at the end of the day, it's Mariana and Pablo and Santiago and Walter having a feel of that. And so we try the data to inform things, but I don't think wine in anywhere in the world can be made on a spreadsheet. So it's one more piece of information that they can use to try and improve the wines.
It is interesting though, because you've had to break down a lot of almost an infinite number of decisions to definite, finite, yes or no questions that you or your owners can make. I think of winemaking almost as a continuum about what you're doing and managing, but actually, in fact, the key decisions have got to be definite points in time.
Absolutely. Well, within a range, as I said, it depending on the weather a given year, you might say, look, I'm going to wait till I get 25 bricks. But if it looks like there's going to be a bunch of rains, or if a frost hits, you got to pick no matter what it's at. So you have to have the ability to have some game time decisions. And what we do is start people out with a few basic decisions. So initially they may only make 8 or 10 decisions, but over time their aim is that they'll make 30, 40, 50 decisions. Again, depending on how much they want to get involved. Some owners want to go from making 5 decisions to 10. Some people want to go from 5 to 100. So depending on the individual client, they determine and self-select how much they want to get involved.
Okay. Does it cost more or less to get more involved? It
costs exactly the same.
It doesn't matter from your point of view.
Okay. We love to have the people engaged. It helps. The more engaged our owners are, the better chance we have of making wines that are going to reflect their desired style.
Yeah, and also the better brand ambassadors they are as well.
And they love it. I mean, that's why we do it, to see that those people create. It's like if you have people over to your house for dinner, you can call in a caterer, and people are probably going to have a great experience, but that's a very different experience than you actually making the food for your guests. And in similar ways for wine, anybody can go out and buy a great bottle of wine, but to actually have that process of creating your own wine and sharing that with your friends, that's really something magical.
Okay. One of the things about life is that things change. So if you've got a vineyard, what's the exit strategy? Just to, someone dies and they need to release the funds, or how does it work? Can they just go into the open market?
They can go on the open market, or we'll help folks that want to get out. We've got a pretty small, I guess it's about, over the last 5 years, maybe 0.5% or so have sold their vineyards. So it's a relatively small amount.
Yeah.
But circumstances change. People can't get down there, or they have kids, or
die, divorce. You know, yeah, all these lots sort of things that can happen. Sure. Exactly. Yeah, 0.5%'s good, but it will be rising as your customers get older. Their lifestyles will change.
Yeah, and sometimes, I mean, a lot of them, one of the interesting things is to see how people get various generations involved. And we've had 3 and 4 generations come down for planting and harvesting. One of the things about wine is that because it's such a long-term thing, you know, we had some folks that came down and their parents, their grandparents, the parents, and the kids. And the kids were really young, 4 or 5 years at the time. Now they're 15. But those vineyards are going to be producing grapes for those kids' grandkids. And so many of our owners think about this in terms of a legacy and creating a project that is going to last for generations. And that is really rare these days that people can do something that has that kind of longevity.
Mm, yeah. As long as it's cost effective, that's the key thing.
It's cost effective. And everyone chooses on ways that they want to spend their money. And some people buy expensive cars. Some people go on vacation. Some people buy a second home. And some people buy vineyards. So the people that are passionate about that, that's the people that are, I think, most happy owning a vineyard.
And can they build on the land?
Larger vineyards. So if there's 6 or more acres, they can build. We've got 7 homes currently on the property, and we'll have a total of 20. But it's a very large property. We have 1,500 acres. So it's not a gated community. I mean, there are a few homes, but they're very spread out.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Oh, and the last thing is, I noticed that you've now got a hotel on site.
We do. 4 years ago, we opened the Vines Resort and Spa. We had a number of owners at that point, and they needed a good place to stay. We're about an hour from Mendoza City, and as the Uco Valley has grown over the last few years, people wanted to come not only out to see their vineyards, but also to stay in the region. So we opened this hotel. Bormida Yanzan and some local architects have designed it, and it's really a wonderful place. It's 22 villas. They're very large villas, indoor-outdoor space, and we've got a phenomenal restaurant there called Siete Fuegos by the chef Francis Malman, who focuses on is really probably the greatest chef dealing with open fire that's in the world, and he's really created something special.
I saw the open fire on your photos. I didn't see many I saw some of the buildings from the outside. I've been on your website looking at them, but I noticed when you got to the chef, all you saw was flames.
That's right. That's exactly. Well, our restaurant's Siete Fuegos, 7 fires in English. So we've embraced the fire.
Excellent. All right then, Michael. I think we'll wrap it up there.
Fantastic.
Cheers.
Thanks.